Briefly, this little yellow pamphlet, we recommend that everyone pick up one if you haven't had one before. In it, you will find the details of the meetings and the dates and the time and so forth, in addition to other information, especially the topic of to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Pugh Judge. Today is being Sunday, the 22nd, the nature and power of soul memory. In addition, you find exact times when we begin and closing and so forth and other useful information. We advise and welcome you to pick up one before you leave. But as is our custom, we do give you the United Lodge of Theosophists, their declaration. Briefly, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is a dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, of creed, of sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. As stated, all other information as to times and dates and so forth are found in this little pamphlet. Pick up one. However, before we begin our discussion this morning, there's a reading that we'll make from a little pamphlet called The Voice of the Silent. More than a pamphlet, I would say. In the middle room is a library table. Stop and talk to the volunteer there. And they'll tell you, or it's you or he, that every Wednesday night we have a library that opens at 5:30.
5:15.
5:15, closes at 7:15. You're welcome to come in and read those, look at those books. You'd be amazed what you will find in there. Any other questions, please address the volunteer on your way out. Our reading this morning, as we said, is from The Voice of the Silence, page 41. And it states, "Be humble, if thou wouldst attain to wisdom. Be humble still when wisdom thou hast mastered. Be like the ocean, which receives all streams and rivers. The ocean's mighty calm remains unmoved. It feels them not. Restrained by the divine, the lower self. restrained by the eternal, the divine. I, great is he who is the slayer of desire. Still greater he in whom the self-divine has slain the very knowledge of desire. Guard thou the lower. This is soil the higher. The way to final liberation is within thyself. The way begins and ends outside of self.
The way to final liberation begins with self. Well, today's talk is on the nature and the power of soul memory. What does that have to do with final liberation? Well, we'll say, you know, memory is a funny thing. There's plenty of times where folks will think that memory is associated with the brain, and that probably makes sense. But by saying that, people think that therefore if the brain is not functioning properly, that you're not going to remember what we perceive. And that's just simply not true, because there's plenty of examples where an individual is on the table in an operating room, their brain is frozen, and their capacity to perceive is absolutely physically, it's not possible to perceive. And yet, they remember everything that went on in that environment. And so, while we use the brain to remember things, and through we perceive through it, it is not the only way that we can perceive, and it is not the perceiver itself. It's just simply an instrument that we use, that the mind uses. So memory can be a funny thing. And if memory is worth anything to us, it has to be worth something if we're here for a purpose, if our life has a purpose, if there's a common goal to all of humanity in the process of evolution. That purpose, that goal is what? Union with the divine. It's the process of evolution where finally we will have recognized our true divine nature and know who we are and see everything around us and recognize the true unity who we are. The process to attain this, well, it's a single goal, but there are actually two paths. One path is the path of final liberation, as it was said in this talk. And the path of final liberation simply means doing what's necessary for yourself to learn the law, to evolve yourself in spiritual ways, so that finally, at the end, your goal is attained and you will enter into nirvana, be one with all. That's one path. The other path, that first one being the path of liberation. The second path is called the path of renunciation. And that path is different because the process of renunciation is really the individual recognizing that if I'm one with all and I'm headed toward a goal, if I reach that goal and everybody else along with me is not there with me when I attain it, can I really enter into nirvana and be in perfect harmony with all when before I enter into it, I know that not everyone is there? So the person who reaches the goal in that sense stops just before the entrance into nirvana, turns around, comes back, and participates, continues to participate with humanity in teaching and assisting and contributing to the evolution of all. This is not something that happens in one life. It happens across many, many lives. But it's something that happens as the result of self-effort. And if it happens as the result of self-effort, then from life to life, if it takes so many lives, you have to remember. Somehow we have to remember where to pick up, where we left off. That's the idea of soul memory. So let's talk about this interesting thing. You know, if you know, for an atheist or a materialist or someone who doesn't believe in the soul, when they think about memory, it's kind of hard to explain really how memory works, because, you know, yesterday we were in the car with our father, stopped at a red light, and he said, "You could have made that red light." And I said, "Well, it's my prerogative to stop." And I reminded him of a red light that he blew through when I was about 6. It was him and my aunt. His car was full of kids. My aunt's car was full of kids. They were probably in their late 20s or early 30s as parents, and my father wanted to beat my aunt home, and he blew the red light. And he was amazed. How could you remember that? Well, let's ask, you know, how does one remember that? All the cells of this body at the age of 51 are completely different than they were when we were 5 or 6. So is memory dependent on the physical brain? How can it be explained by someone who does not recognize that there's two sides of nature, the visible and the invisible? Theosophy presents ideas. It is a complete philosophy of nature that does not just stick to the physical, but it includes all departments of nature, so that we can take steps toward understanding these questions and these problems in their fullness rather than only partially, so that if we were a scientist or a medical doctor, we don't have to say, well, most of the time the patient really would have died, but sometimes they don't, because I really can't believe that they didn't, and he's afraid to say that there must have been something more just than the physical thing happening. So this memory can be an interesting thing. Well, there are three functions of memory, and these functions are two of them are specifically related to the outside world. And so an example of the first one, which we would call remembrance, is that's an example where an experience conjures up a certain feeling within us. And because we feel that way, we envision, recognize, and put to reconstruct a certain aspect of our lives that we lived in the past. An example of this is one day we're walking through a parking lot, interestingly enough, and we get a blast of diesel fume into my face. And the way that makes me feel, for most people, it would be agitating. But for me, I loved it. And I realized why, and instantaneously I knew. It's because years ago, I was in Northern Europe for several years in the army on M1 tanks in the middle of January with the snow blowing at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's freezing. But if you're with M1 tanks, the exhaust blows out of the tanks at 900 degrees. So if you're standing there real close to the exhaust, you're warm. You're smelling the diesel, but you're feeling the warmth and you're grateful that you have it. So recently when we had that experience, we recalled we remembered that whole experience. So we have a particular feeling today, and it brings, you know, a whole remembrance of something in the past. That's remembering, and it's triggered by something outside of us. A second function of memory is recollection. And recollection is when we recall something in particular and are able then to kind of tie particular other points to it. And a very simple example of this is trying to remember where we left the keys, because I usually put them on the hook, but when I came in yesterday, they're not on the hook. The kids were yelling. I heard them in the backyard. I walked out in the backyard, and I saw that Johnny was this, and I probably left them, and they're on the picnic table in the backyard. So the recollection, the process of recollection, is remembering a specific thing of what happened and working through the other particular points of that memory. Now, that's on one side of the physical scale. Remembrance is on the other side of the physical scale. And there's kind of a continuum. You know, some recollections also include some remembrance. Some remembrance also includes recollection. But then the third kind of memory is what we call reminiscence. And reminiscence, from a theosophical view, is a direct recognition, a direct perception of the soul, direct knowledge of something that we already know and have assimilated into ourselves, without having to use the physical brain for input, specific knowledge, without having to know anything or be triggered by anything outside of us. It doesn't use the physical brain. Certainly it uses the physical brain in the sense that the idea or the reminiscence, the memory, is within us, and it comes through us using our physical brain to express, for whatever reason, we're expressing a particular memory. And this is different because it comes from within outward. So in certain ways, the way that that functions is not too different from the way that we remember dreams. Dreams are in between our fully waking state and our fully deep sleeping state. In between is the dream. And the dream is the process or the function of the ideas being brought back with us from our deepest state of sleep, filtering through our brains. And if our brains are porous enough to the ideas of the soul, then we get an idea of what our experience was. And that can be a warning, that can be the recognition of a particular truth that has application to our situation in life. There's a number of different things that these dreams can have. But that's just a small example of what the potential of reminiscence can be. So if we have memory within the soul, and the soul is, as we said, I mean, we are ever living, immortal, spiritual beings, then some people would say, well, what do we need to do to access this memory so that we know all of these things that are on the tablets, the astral tablets of our soul? And it really has to do with the way that we think. If we think along certain lines of the I, me, my, you know, it's, you know, I am my ideas, I am these emotions, I am this body, then we're building certain aspects of our brain that are focused toward the particular, the outer, the transient. And so then in that sense, everything that we learn and remember in life, you know, as our brains change, we're not going to remember as much. But if we live in certain ways and think and act and recognize ourselves as the spirit who we are, and live from that point as a basis from which to think and act and feel, then this has an effect literally on our brain. It makes our brain, our physical brain, more porous to the ideas and the dictums of our soul. So there's two things there, you know. So where are we? Well, it really depends. Everybody's different. We're all on the path. But what's helpful to remember is this all occurs under law. There's no accidents. If we're going to make the decision to expand our awareness or learn more about ourselves, about our inner nature, then there are certain things that we need to accept, such as there's no one who's really going to do it for us. Any kind of inner work that we have to do is not going to be done by anyone except the inner man. And that takes effort, and that takes time, and that takes discipline. it occurs under law. Well, how much work does it take? Think about it. Think about this, just hypothetically, the substance of what we use to think in any situation all through our daily lives. Let's just divide it in two. We're not going to divide it in half because there might be more on one side than the other. But we'll divide it in two. Question. The one side is the side of our brain that is constructed by us willfully, deliberately, thoughtfully, mindfully, based on what we know to be true, based on checking our ideas, verifying ideas that other people talk to us about, and the effect of that all of this process of thinking has on our brain. So what percentage of this thinking thing that I use is a function of what I personally have made the effort to construct in conscious, willful, mindful ways? Then the other half, or the other side of the picture, is how much of my brain is there because of all of the TV that I watch? How much of it is there because I sit and listen to people's opinions, and if it sounds like they're probably smarter than me, I just take it for granted? How much, outside authorities, how much of this is the result of passive conditioning? So the difference is part of what we think with is the result of actively constructing it based on our inner knowledge. And the other part is what the world has convinced us of. You know, there's a saying, parents, this rings true often, we've heard, that your child's mind is a sponge. And if you don't fill it with ideas, somebody else will. Well, isn't that true for all of us? If I don't test, check, and verify the ideas, then I'll accept those that somebody else wants me to believe. So when we say, well, this bit about soul memory and having full recollection and universal, well, you know, so how do we do it? Well, first we have to realize under law, we're at a certain place. Where am I? And what steps do I need to take in terms of my thinking to move forward? We got sidetracked there. So I know. So please make nouns past. We had an acronym and we forget it. Please make nouns. Hold on. As you can tell, I've completely memorized everything I've prepared. Oh, got it. So since I've got it out, in the Ocean of Theosophy, and the Ocean of Theosophy is a text, kind of a synthesis of the secret doctrine. It's a book that was written by one of the founders of the Theosophical Society that we use as a textbook, which offers us the principles of the philosophy. The more you study it, the more you apply it, the more you may find the truths inherent in it. Well, in the Ocean of Theosophy, there's a statement, and it says, a Mahatma endowed with power over space, time, mind, and matter is a possibility just because he is a perfected man. Every human being, here's the point, every human being has the germ of all the powers attributed to these great initiates. Say it again. Every human being has the germ, singular, of all the powers, plural, attributed to these great initiates. So the powers over mind, space, spirit, and time all have a common source. And the germ that Mr. Judge is talking about is self-consciousness. The germ of self-consciousness in the human being is the source of our power to look around, to recognize and discern truth from fiction. It's the power to take responsibility for our lives and build it in certain ways so that we live according to law. But the theosophical teaching is that it's not good enough just to live according to law, although that's your personal business if that's what you're going to do. Rather, our purpose is to live and learn in certain ways so that we are the better able to help and teach others to follow that path which leads to final liberation for all by renunciation of particular rewards. We, along the way, we live our lives in certain ways so that whatever comes as the result of our causes, that's fine, but we don't do that to get it. So when we set causes and effects, our motive is to do what's right because it's the right thing to do, rather than to do what we need to do to get what we want. If we want the goal of final liberation personally, that's your business. But if we have the germ, the self-consciousness, to gain power, as the Mahatmas have, over time, space, spirit, and matter, then yes, we are immortal spirit working through these physical vehicles, but we will become immortal, not just in spirit, but also immortal in matter for the entire rest of this period of evolution if we do the things necessary to live in service to others. And that is all tied in to living in such a way that it changes the way we construct our life, it changes the physical construction literally of our brain, it makes us more porous to the ideas of the soul, and having lived for so many, many lives just on Earth for 18 million years, yes, there's a lot going on within our soul, and the nature of the soul is to be available to those who would use the information or to use the wisdom for benefit of others. So the question is, what's your memory? Why are you back here? Are you here in order to attain the goal for yourself? Or are you here to do what's necessary to live your life in such a way that you help everybody and all things attain the goal collectively? So, we're sure you've come here with ideas and questions and contributions. You're certainly welcome.
Certainly, if somebody should try to meditate, they recognize that memory has a certain power that can be very distracting and be an obstacle to meditation. On the other hand, in the same effort, memory is very important when we try to meditate. And most of the time it's because we forget. We may understand and remember everything during this meeting, but 5 minutes after we walk out, we may forget what we heard here. What can we do to practice mindfulness, or put it another way, to help eliminate this tendency to forget what we know to be true?
So what can we do in a practical way in our daily lives so that we don't forget about this? Well, in order to not forget about this, we need to make a habit of it. And so meditation was mentioned. And, you know, anybody who doesn't meditate, you know, if you start to meditate 20 minutes a day, you'll improve your life. That's just how it works. Make the effort to do it. We're not saying that we're here to give a class on how to meditate, because really, it's a very subjective experience. Make the effort through trial and failure, learn how to meditate. And there are theosophical teachings along that line if you're interested. So during meditation, yes, memory can be a real distraction and memory can be a real help. It can be a distraction because part of meditation is concentrating the mind on a particular universal value, or a particular, not a particular, but on a universal value, on a universal idea, and to hold one's mind, that to practice holding one's mind just for a few minutes. If part of your 20 minutes is just for 5 minutes, is a long time to actually successfully do that. You know, it's something simple, something universal. You know, watch a rose bloom. Watch it in your mind. That is training for your mind, and it helps us to gain control of the distractions of the lower mind and the emotions and the checkbook and my late for work and all this kind of things. So that's the first thing. But also, what's helpful is, and this was actually taught by Pythagoras to his students, is the practice of retrospection. And retrospection is the process simply of each day, looking back over the day, taking 10 minutes by yourself quietly, not before you go to bed, and look at your day, not starting with breakfast and working to dinner, but starting with right now and working our way backwards. Not from cause to effect, but from effect to cause, effect to cause. And we do that, when we do that, we begin to see more clearly the operation of law. And when we do that, we have to keep ourselves detached emotionally from it, because we're not doing it to judge whether or not we did stuff right or wrong and to condemn ourselves, but just to see what the effects were from the cause. When we do this, this is nothing new. I mean, this is nothing uncommon, really. I mean, football teams do this every week. They look at what happened in the game, and they view the tapes, and they learn from the tapes every time. That's retrospection, the philosophical process of retrospection. Except when we do that, we have to be careful, as we said, not to place judgment on it. And when we see something that perhaps needs to be corrected, something we said, something we should have said, do it right away. If possible, do it before the end of the day. But even if we see something that, you know what, sometimes words are said and words can't be taken back. Sometimes we do things and you can't undo things. But that's not a terrible thing. If you can't change that particular instance, then create a new instance. If you created that problem, you can create something new and different. And if nothing else, do it in honor of or in the name of the problem that you had. Either take steps to fix, or if it can't be right now, then just create something anew. There's a hand here, yeah.
Yes. Is there any form of memory that contributes to character? And if so, could you give us some insight?
So what kind of memories, or what function of memory contributes to character? Character is perhaps a synonym for soul. Character is a synonym for the immortal ego. Character, so when we do the things and endure the challenges that strengthen our character, what are we really doing? What we're doing is we are either in the moment experiencing the fullness that we can what we're doing and learning from it, or if we're meditating every day, as we reflect on our day, we're reflecting on the things of the day and learning from it, and the highest aspects of it are assimilated into our inner nature. The highest aspirations and spiritual experiences of our lives are assimilated into our character. That's what edifies the character. Now, the thing is, there's a lot going on in the world, and if we're not doing what's necessary on a consistent basis to assimilate those experiences into our character, then all that really means is we don't benefit from those experiences along the way in this lifetime, and we don't grow as we could from the effort that we're putting out. Because all of those experiences and all of those higher aspirations, if we haven't assimilated them into our character by the time that we pass and we rest this physical body down, we go into a state of rest and bliss because the energy of it didn't go away. The energy of it is still in the fullness of our being, and we have to take the time between lives of reflection and assimilation and learning, and our character will benefit, has to benefit under law. It'll either benefit in the moment or over the course of our life as we assimilate that, but it's going to the efforts that we put forth to be of service to others and to be a better person, it's going to come back to us in the form of strengthening our character, and that's strengthening our soul, and that's all part of the process of enlightenment. And there's been a hand in the blue here.
Was it said that there was an acronym that you thought of to help us remember how to do this?
No, the acronym was for us to remember the different parts of the talk, which completely went out the window, but that's okay. Yes?
I just wanted to go back to the part when you talked about 10-minute reflection mm-hmm. in the end of the day. So you said it's not from breakfast to dinner time, so how do you know which parts of your day specifically you're supposed to reflect on, which situations that require attention? We're going back into analyzing like what's been done and what's caused the effect. Like, how do you know? Do you pick certain situations? Do you like? Is that what my mind thinks? That's what's been important to go back and reflect.
Sure.
Or is it like in general, just going and like viewing your day?
No. Well, certainly it's the whole day. Except perhaps we didn't say it right. What we meant to say is instead of starting at breakfast time and working forward, I did this, I caused this, this is what the effect, this is the cause, this is the effect. Instead of doing that way, it's more helpful to start with right now and start backing up one event at a time, look at the effect. Well, what caused that? Well, that's the effect of something else. And going backward, what we meant to do is go backwards through the whole day. And certainly we're going to spend more time reflecting on certain parts of the day than others. But sure, go back through the whole day. And what that helps us to do is to stand back impersonally and unemotionally and do our best just to see the laws at work. And an analogy of this is when you've written something that's really, really important, and you don't want to rely on spell checker because you can't afford to have the comma wrong. When you reread it to proofread it for spelling, it's helpful to read it in reverse so that you're reading every single word and paying more attention to every word rather than letting it skim through your mind. We found that to be helpful. So, clear? Okay, yes.
To go back to 5 minutes after we leave here, we forget much of the wisdom that we heard. Not everyone is in a position to be able to meditate or to feel such universal love for the world. They can barely get along in their family, let alone have that. So we think you can take some practical steps, and one is to realize you forget what you've heard here because you're busy remembering something else. And it's to sort of make for yourself a plan. What do I want to know? What do I want to understand? And if I have to seek wisdom, then I am going to have to give up something else in my life and sort of replant my desires. So memory is the enemy and the best friend all at the same time. And we have to achieve that balance between them.
Thank you. So the contribution basically is, I guess some people are too busy to be spiritual. And if you want to add that to, and if you want to add that to the palette, it's got to be fit in. We know what you're saying, but if we're going to allot certain resources to something new that's worthy, we got to look at what we have and get rid of something that's unworthy so that we make room or make time for the worthy. There was a hand here.
Yeah, I had two quick things to go over. One thing was about the two paths, but I'll get quickly get back to that. I wanted to discuss soul memory and inherited phobias. Now, there was a study called Inheriting Fears of Fathers where, we won't get too specific about it, but it shows that the soul can really imprint fears that, I guess, would carry on to this incarnation where, like, I'm not afraid of heights, but I have a rational fear of falling, you know, opposed to somebody that would be afraid of heights, like, irrationally. Do you think that has something to do with something in their past lives or something that had, an impactful effect on their being, like, if they died from falling or something like that? And the other thing was...
Okay, let's address that. Let's address that. Well, if it's an inheritance, then this fear of falling is you know, likely not an inheritance from our parents, but inheritance from ourselves,
right,
because it's a tendency from previous lives. Is that the point?
Yeah,
okay.
That's what I meant. Now, the two paths, you had said there's final conditioning and... I'm sorry, I'm trying to find the final conditioning.
Liberation and renunciation?
And liberation, yeah. Now, kind of what I got from that is either which way, you kind of get to the end and turn back around.
So the question is, let's discern what's going on with liberation versus renunciation. Liberation is, in this great period of evolution, when you reach the goal, you say, I earned it, I want it, I'm done. Do you start back around in the next period of evolution? Yes, you do.
Okay.
Renunciation is the tendency, if you have the tendency just to do things, keep control of yourself, just kidding. If you have the tendency to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do and you're doing it not for yourself but for others, then when you get to the goal, you renounce the goal. That's the tendency. That's the makeup of your character. And the idea of great prophets or spiritual teachings being with mankind, that is found universally in all, you know, on all different continents, through all different times, highly evolved individuals. They weren't made by, in theosophical view, in the view of the wisdom tradition, they weren't made by God to be big spiritual people to help us. They were made by themselves, by self-devised effort and, you know, self-motivated methods to grow in certain ways, and they choose to remain and be of service to others. That's the distinction. Yes?
We notice that every Sunday, members of the family go to devotional services at a particular church. And the key here is devotional services. They participate in various songs and readings and so forth. Yet, according to what we read, volunteered to read this morning, it mentioned something about independent devotion. And it explains what seeds are required to develop independent devotion. So that word devotion, it comes up all the time. Could you explain to us,
sure,
what do you mean by independent devotion?
So, thank you. So one of the differences, you know, between the theosophical view of the world and life and humanity, as opposed to, you know, typical Christians, is, you know, I mean, if Christians would simply read the Sermon on the Mount, they'll find that Jesus said that don't get together and collectively pray and make a big public deal about it. He just says don't do it. He just says don't do it. Theosophically, we recognize that as good advice. And so each of us here isn't being told what to believe. We're here to learn and to contribute. This is a collectivity of independent associates, volunteers, souls who learn from each other and with each other, but are not sheep directed to. So the devotion comes in of learning from the books, sure, but really, if you're not taking that and learning through life, then really you're missing a lot. You're missing out a lot. So we talk about through study and otherwise. You know, the study is not to be misunderstood in terms of come in and sit in the library and read theosophical books. The study is the study of life in this laboratory of the world. Be the alchemist. And there's a hand. Oh, yes, there's been a hand here.
Before one could enter the school, the Pythagoras, the Pythagorean school, one had to have knowledge, a good foundation in both music and geometry. And we were wondering if that, if their bases for memory, especially like the reminiscence and the soul memory, does anyone know what his purpose was in requiring those two subjects specifically?
Okay, well, requiring those two subjects specifically?
Yeah.
Well, of course, we're not going to pretend we're an authority on it. We're not. We can't pretend we're an authority on it, but we could. if we look at it, I mean, really, we're not here to say that, you know, you have to be smart in order to be spiritual. But there are certain things that were necessary in the Platonic and the Pythagorean schools that were prerequisites to entering into that school. There were also very definite prerequisites in all of the mystery schools to be accepted into the inner esoteric circles. There was the exoteric, the crowd, as Jesus said, he teaches in parables to the masses, but teaches in secret the kingdoms of heaven. And so, well, there must be some kind of process necessary in order to prepare ourselves to get to be ready to understand some of these ideas. And that process, as was said, Pythagoras was big on mathematics, geometry, and music. The great mystery schools of the world had certain standards that had to be met, including ethical standards, before people are introduced. So we'll invite contributions along that line.
We certainly don't know, but at least what we know about the brain today, since that was brought up in the talk, the effort needed to master music or geometry develops that part of our brain that is involved with the perception of universal concepts, ideas, as opposed to particulars. And of course, Pythagoras was very big in his philosophical approach from going from universals to particulars. So just in terms of conditioning the brain to be porous to the soul's realizations, there had to be a certain conditioning, preparation of the nervous aspect, just as well as discipline of the body.
So the contribution has to do with, first of all, when we talk about geometry in particular, that's the one course even today, the one course, the singular course, the only course in all of the mathematics and sciences that are taught where it is required that the student develop his faculties to learn from universals to particulars. Everything else is particulars, bouncing things on two sides of the equal sign. That's completely a different process of thinking. And then second, the contribution is also, and you know, anybody who's taken clarinet lessons for 5 years and practiced an hour a day, there are certain things that you do to master the clarinet, the violin, the piano, which in certain ways may not be assimilated into the soul, depending, you know, whatever songs you're learning. However, the discipline and the will that is required that one develops, that becomes a part of your inner character. And we can only imagine that certain subjects, esoteric, require similar discipline. And if it hasn't been developed in the mundane spheres, how are you going to develop it in these higher spheres? Yes?
As we understand it, and Pythagoras is a wonderful subject to read about, since for all we know, we were part of that school, for all we know.
Thank you.
But that music from which we have the term the muse.
Mm-hmm.
Music was the prerequisite, and later it was broken down into the other subjects, and it is a question of discipline. When you joined that school for 12 years, you never said a word. You would be given an idea and allowed to ponder it, and then you'd be questioned on it later. This is after the 12 years, so it was obviously very rigorous. But we wanted to go back for just a moment to the one who elects final liberation, nirvana, leaving this earth. And while it is said that, yes, that soul does pick up again in the next period of evolution, they also have a karmic debt that they will have to face for neglecting humanity, for not following through on their duty. So you pay, obviously, a very big price for choosing liberation.
Thank you for the contribution, and that contribution is heard very clear. We appreciate that. Also, when we're talking about Pythagoras and music, we're told that Pythagoras is actually the one who coined the word philosophy. And philosophy, what it means to certain academics today is completely different from back then. Philosophy, coming up through the centuries, is all of the natural sciences. Biology, chemistry, history, all the arts, all the arts and sciences were philosophy. And so we can have an appreciation for the requirements that he put forth to get into his school. Even now, we get a doctor of philosophy degree in chemistry, a doctor of philosophy in art, a doctor for, you see that stems all the way back to Pythagoras and through the universities of ancient Europe or medieval Europe. Yes?
And going back for a moment to the idea of our fourth of meditation, where we go back and try impersonally, dispassionately look at the cause and effects, and then we make a judgment as to what was right and wrong and how we can do it better, or at least we need to recognize that something is wrong. How could we do that without the power of soul memory? Where is that discernment, that discrimination coming from, if not from soul memory?
Right, so when we reflect on our day, how would it be possible to do so without the power of soul memory? Because just the fact that soul memory is the reason for the continuity of thought. Without soul memory, specific impressions at each point in time and space and everything, it would be what it is, and there would be no recognizable continuity of it. Is that where you're going with
it? But we have to make a moral judgment based on our experience of what is right and wrong. Where does that memory,
right,
the conscience, or the moral discernment come from if it's not from soul memory? Does it come from the brain? Does it come from the senses?
So we can look on things that went on in the day and make a personal judgment, subjective judgment, on whether or not that was the right thing to do. And there's something within us that is knowing, from our perspective, whether or not that was the right thing to do. Well, how does he know what's the right thing to do? Because he's been there before. Because he's been in those situations. Because he's been thoughtfully reflecting on this, and he's saying, oh, here we go again, and he is who we are. The question is, are we going to follow the my personal animal soul of our being, or are we going to turn it over to our higher nature? And it's the same thing, everybody's done it, when you're in math class and you go through this whole math problem and you're done with it, and you know that's not the right answer. You know it's not. It can't be that. Well, how do you know? It's because some way you know what the right answer should be. And so you can go back through and what? Test, check, and verify the steps along your math problem. Right? In the green.
Also, if we look at the idea that it is an innate quality of past knowledge, there is a part of us that knows. There is a part that has to fumble through life. That's that duality within us. But in a small child.
So the contribution here is that germ that we were talking about, the germ of the powers over space, time, matter, and mind, which is fully evolved in the Mahatma, it's there in every human being. It is the germ of it is there in every human being. And there, you know, we're all evolving in different ways along certain lines, and we're all here to help each other, but we all have it. And so when we reflect on what our situation is, you know, one individual may reflect on his situation and say, yep, that was fine. Another may reflect on the same thing that he did and say, no, that's not good enough. That's not the right standard. That's not the moral. That's not what I was taught. This is because simply they both have the power of reflection, and they both have the power to live or to grow and understand in wisdom. But when we're wearing a different shade of glasses, one is rosy and one is yellow, and different people have different, we see things in different ways. So the goal here is, as we grow, recognize, discern the wheat from the chaff, and try to wear the clear glasses so that we can see all of our thoughts and actions and interactions objectively from a more universal perspective. So in the future, as we act and think and talk and feel, we're doing so in a sensitive, compassionate way, identifying with the people around us to be of service to others. And to do that, ultimately, you have to operate from our higher nature rather than our personal stuff, right? Yes?
We're not sure if it was in the reading that was done from the chair or something that was said, but we believe we heard the phrase "become immortal," and then very soon after that, but the germ, we think we were talking about Mahatmas, but the germ is within all. If the germ of that possibility of perfection is within all, aren't we already immortal?
So aren't we already immortal? Perhaps we misspoke, but we think what that was related to was the Mahatma lives immortally in spirit and matter. He is not subject to the delusion of life and death and new bodies and reincarnation. He has a vesture which is permanent through the entire, so he has mastered, he is immortal both in spirit and matter. That was what we meant to say. There was, yes, last question.
Well, we recall hearing in this room from the audience, get knowledge. And get knowledge, now you may have a college degree, etc. What does it mean? Get knowledge. And is it in that declaration a seed idea?
Okay, so what in the declaration directs us along this line of learning? Well, simply the exemplification of the fundamental principles of the philosophy, living them in practice, is how we grow. That's how we learn. We don't learn by reading theosophy. We learn theosophy by doing theosophy, by turning it into an action word. And one example of an ancient teacher who lived this life on the path of renunciation is a teacher called Kuan Yin. And from her descends this statement, a pledge, never will I seek nor receive private individual salvation. Never will I enter into final peace alone, but forever and everywhere will I live and strive for the redemption of every creature throughout the world. Our meeting is adjourned.